From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. A lot of news happened in Iowa this past year, from the ousting of three state Supreme Court justices to the re-election of Iowa's longest-serving governor, an Iowa native receiving the Medal of Honor, and the largest troop deployment for the Iowa National Guard since the Second World War. This hour, the top 10 Iowa news stories of 2010. We'll review and discuss the stories with my guests, Cedar Rapids Gazette columnist Todd Dorman, Douglas Burns of the Daily Times Herald and Carroll, and our own Iowa Public Radio Statehouse reporter Janine Beck. The top 10 Iowa news stories of 2010, right after this hour's news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and today you're listening to an encore edition of the program. This hour, we'll be counting down what we see as the top 10 Iowa news stories at Iowa Public Radio of the year 2010, and we want to reach out to you listeners and tell you no calls today because of the nature of our countdown show, but you can find Iowa Public Radio's top 10 news story list on Facebook. We're also on Twitter, so leave behind a comment or send us a tweet. Perhaps you think we missed a story or got the stories not in the quite top 10 countdown list order you would have put them in. I want to welcome our guests to review and discuss this, the top 10 list this hour. Cedar Rapids Gazette columnist Todd Dorman is with us. Todd, welcome to our program. Welcome back, I should say.
Yeah, thank you. Glad to be here.
Doug Burns is with us of the Daily Times Herald in Carroll, joining us by phone. Hello, Doug.
Good morning, Ben.
Great to have you with us again. And our own Statehouse reporter, Iowa Public Radio's Janine Beck in our Des Moines studio. Good afternoon to you, Janine.
Hi, Ben.
Well, let's get right to it. A lot of stories to cover this hour. Let's start off with what we saw at on our news staff as number 10, this amazing story of basketball from the University of Northern Iowa. It was the Northern Iowa Panthers were playing the University of Kansas in the second round of the NCAA basketball tournament. That was back in March, March 20th. Kansas was the overall number one seed, and the Panthers were at number nine and were huge underdogs in the game. With 35 seconds left in the game and UNI leading by 1 point, CBS had the broadcast.
Farouk Benesh, a three.
Good! You can't be serious with that shot.
30 seconds left on the clock. The three-pointer sealed the game for the Panthers. 69-67 the win. It was the first time the Panthers reached the Sweet 16, the first time the Panthers had played a number one seed, and the first time someone from the Missouri Valley Conference had beaten a number one seed since going back to 1962. Do our journalists from across the state have any observations about that? Todd Dorman, you're in this part of the state where the Panthers were big in 2010.
Anybody who watched that game will never forget that shot. He was all by himself as the clock was running down, and you know, a lot of players might have just waited for the rest of the guys to come down, and he just fired it off with no hesitation. I always remember sitting on the couch watching that game. That was crazy.
And this year, how are the Panthers looking for the coming year?
It's going to be hard to recreate that sort of run, but I think they'll be a pretty good team by the end of the year.
Doug, I believe you did you see that game live as well?
Oh, absolutely, and was even planning a trip to go to St. Louis where they played subsequently. And Todd's right, that's undeniably, that was a heroic shot by Farouk Manesh. But one thing I couldn't help but thinking and watching that game was, you know, I followed the NCAA tournament since the 80s when you had giants like Georgetown and North Carolina and Duke. And because players are able to leave to go to the NBA now, you know, what you and I did is, you know, certainly exceptional in Iowa, but on a national scale, really not all that spectacular because the talent's so diluted in Division I college basketball. Mm-hmm.
Do we get the idea here that with Panther basketball, this is the beginning of a trend or more of a one-off win?
Well, I think it's, as Doug was saying, I mean, you've got a situation now in college basketball where the Northern Iowas of the world have so much more. Such a better shot at driving deep into the tournament. Well, I mean, Butler played for the national championship, and that would be a school about the size, or maybe even smaller than UNI. But yeah, I mean, these are the moments of March Madness. This is why everyone tunes in. I mean, you know, Ali Farouk Manesh for the rest of his life gets to be in the elite highlight reel that they show of people going crazy, big shots. I mean, that's a pretty special thing.
The Panther basketball scene for 2010 making our top 10 news list of 2010 for Iowa Public Radio. I want to touch on a couple of tragedies that were in our news. Of course, tragedy is a big part of news as reported across the state and across the country. The Mark Becker trial on April 14th, Mark Becker was sentenced to life in prison for killing Applington Parkersburg football coach Ed Thomas. That was in June of 2009. Becker walked into the school's weight training room, shot Ed Thomas several times. This was one of the biggest stories of the 2009, but also certainly carried over into 2010. Got a lot of attention. Another tragedy we all remember on July 4th, the small town of Bellevue in far eastern Iowa. Two horses pulling a buggy. They broke free, trampled people in the crowd. A 60-year-old woman died. Four were critically injured, and more than a dozen more people had minor injuries. Here's what Mayor Virgil Murray said at a news conference following the incident. He described the response of emergency responders.
Our medical people at that time took over and did an amazing job of setting up triage along the street. I think it was along a six-block area, treating injured people, of which there were 22 to 24, I'm not sure of that number, but close, 24, let's say, and had them all either in an ambulance or I think we had a medevac helicopter here, anyway, on their way to a hospital within an hour's time.
Murray also went on to say how people in the crowd pitched in. He called it a community coming together during a time of great tragedy. Thoughts on this from our journalists? Todd, maybe I can start with you and go to others.
No, it's just it's painful to see. I mean, so many of us have children. We've taken them to parades. We've been in scenes like this. I mean, it's a emblematic scene of rural Iowa, a small town parade. And to see something like this happen, and the mayor's right. I mean, the response was swift, and to watch the footage that people took of that happening, it's amazing that more people weren't severely injured.
Mm-hmm. And Doug and Janine, jump in on this if you feel you'd like to. Any lessons learned here that parades will be changed to prevent this from possibly happening in the future?
Well, Ben, I go to the Kentucky Derby every year, and I've been on the backside watching the. Literally, the tons of horses come around, and it gives you an appreciation for the power of the animals. So I think too often with people around Christmas time now out buying their pets toys and gifts and treating them like they're humans, I think this serves as a reminder that the animal kingdom, while lovely and beautiful, can sometimes be frightening. It also raises an issue about small-town government. We had some people here that wanted to run cage fighting events in Carroll, and it just makes you wonder if a government at our level, at the very small town council level, is able to regulate and understand some of these cultural activities that different promoters put forward in a community.
Mm-hmm. Janine Beck, either one of these tragedies, a comment on the Bellevue trampling or the Becker trial?
I think what was just, I did not cover the Bellevue trampling much. I watched it unfold more like a spectator, everybody else who saw it in the news. But obviously, the one thing that was very beneficial to them is that because it was a parade and small town parades feature local emergency responders, fire trucks and things like that, they were there on the scene as it happened, which I think obviously was helpful in that case. And, the Ed Thomas thing, the thing that struck me about that, granted, that was the shooting was actually the year prior, but what made this such big news last year, obviously the sentencing of Mark Becker, but the family was so involved in trying to pass and successfully passing legislation that now they hope will prevent future shootings in that style, in the sense that Mark Becker had been in a psychiatric hospital. He'd been treated after going on this massive chase with law enforcement just days before. And when he was released, no one was notified and police had asked to be, but, it didn't happen. And so now there is a requirement that if someone comes in after that kind of, if police bring them in and they're wanted on questioning or charges and they're there for some reasons, they have to notify police upon their relief, mm-hmm. Their release. And maybe that will make a difference. In the
and
future.
This is at a state level, this law change.
That's right. In mm-hmm. fact, they were there lobbying the day the verdict was announced. That's how important it was to the family. Members of the family came to Des Moines to the state house to lobby and then drove back as fast as they could to be back in time for that verdict.
This is The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer, and you're listening to an archive edition of our program today. Janine Beck of Iowa Public Radio, Iowa Public Radio State House reporter, along with Doug Burns of the Daily Times Herald in Carroll and Cedar Rapids Gazette columnist Todd Dorman with us this hour as we're counting down the top Iowa news stories of 2010. No calls today because of the nature of our countdown show, but you can find Iowa Public Radio's top 10 news story list on Facebook. We're also on Twitter. Leave behind a comment after you visit or send us a tweet. Let's move on to, what seems to be always news, no matter what year it is. It has different faces. The weather is played out in a severe way for many people, many parts of Iowa, as it is every year. The weather made news. Records have been kept by the state climatologist's office for 138 years. Starting with the winter, there was an above-average snowfall, if we think back a year ago. 2010 already is and will likely remain the wettest year on record. So far, there have been about 44.5 inches of rainfall this year. The average is 34. This past June had the most precipitation on record. That was the month of June. And then despite the precipitation, there was an extremely dry period between September, the end of September, and the end of October, where the statewide average precipitation for that time was only 0.04 inches. Todd Dorman, you are one of your pet fascinations is the weather. I know that. What are your thoughts on this past weather year?
Well, the statistics speak for themselves. I mean, it was a very wet year and at times extreme. I mean, as someone who lives in Cedar Rapids, in the Cedar Rapids area, I mean, obviously we had the flooding in 2008. All of these trend lines are alarming as far as rainfall, and there are lots of indications that something's going on. I know that's a hot political debate to try to determine what exactly is going on, climate change or what have you. But I think one of the big stories going forward, or I think one of the big stories that that should be going forward is how does state government in particular respond to these statistics? How do they respond to the notion or the proof that, you know, Iowa's weather pattern is wetter and we are going to see more flooding? It seems like in the last few legislative sessions there have been things filed, things discussed, but as far as watershed management's concerned, but we just haven't seen a lot of action on that. And I think what we've seen in extremes should be driving more of a debate, but for some reason it just hasn't.
Janine Beck, covering the State House, do you see the weather influencing the severe weather we've had this past year? I think I said the wettest year on record. I meant to say the second wettest year on record. 93, of course, the first wettest year. Do you see that driving any legislation?
Well, there are members, especially those from the Cedar Rapids area. Senator Rob Hogue, a Democrat from Cedar Rapids, is, you know, trying to hammer hard on this, saying, let's not forget. And, you know, they had a smart planning task force over the interim to talk about requiring cities to do certain things when they plan in floodplains and map out future development in cities. But these are, you know, Iowa is a local control state, and whenever legislature tries to get involved in telling a community where they can build, where they can't, that affects their tax dollars and their bottom line, communities tend to balk. So, yeah, I mean, Todd's right that this needs to be an issue that the legislature deals with, but politically it's very difficult.
Mm-hmm. And Doug, out there in the western part of the state, Doug Burns of the Daily Times Herald in Carroll, I know the weather dealt that area where you cover and you live a presidential disaster declaration. These are related to ice storms out in western Iowa. Tell us about those.
Yeah, correct. I'm 41 years old and have lived the majority of my life here in the Carroll area, and I've never seen a storm like that. The ice was just brutal. The way it collected around the utility lines, it was just awful for the utility companies. And I think certainly local people would have liked to see the state and federal government respond more quickly. In the community here, I know in the outlying areas there were some people that were without power, but I really viewed it as really more of largely an inconvenience, than a disaster. And I sort of thought it was interesting that a lot of the conservatives that are quick to say they want no government involvement sure thought that Governor Culver and President Obama themselves should be in town picking up sticks and stacking them in the front yard for people. I think a lot of us just handled our own problems, and the utility companies did a good job of coming in. They're still, dealing with some fallout from that.
Mm-hmm. And then almost as if to say it was sorry, the weather dealt people who were harvesting a wonderful harvest time. Warm and dry weather combined with a very mature crop allowed our harvests to proceed at a very rapid pace, with nearly all of the soybeans, 97% of the corn harvested at the month's end of that would have been October. Huge change from last season. If we think back, the harvest season of 2009, the slowest pace in that since 1951. Thoughts on the weather and the harvest, Todd?
Well, maybe back to the point that Janine talked about with in the legislature with watershed management and those things. It is tough because you've got, I mean, you're goring some fairly important oxes when you talk about changing land use planning and changing the way farm agriculture is practiced. But, you know, it's a taxpayer stewardship issue, too, because, you know, there's going to be increased flooding and there's going to be, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars of damage that government's going to have to help cover. And so if we can somehow prevent that from happening, if we can somehow get more of our commercial and residential activity out of the harm's way and let these rivers, I guess the term is breathe when they're full, I think we'd, you know, the taxpayers would probably be ahead in the long run. But it's, you know, it's a tough political sell because, you know, when the water's not rising and it's not an emergency, people don't get too excited about it.
When what Todd just talked about, he talked about agriculture, which I hadn't really mentioned. I was talking about telling cities how they can plan. But, you know, there's a large component of that. We have a lot of tiled land in Iowa so that the water runs right off the farmlands and into these rivers and streams more quickly so that the crops can stay dry, so that you can have dry fields to plant and harvest. And there are some saying, okay, well, then we've got to do something to slow that down. We've got to have some strips of grass before it hits the river, something. And again, those are private landowners and that don't typically take kindly to the state telling them how to manage their property. But again, eventually we all pay for it some way.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the more flooding in many parts of Iowa in 2010, flooding in Ames, Colfax, Des Moines, mm-hmm. Newton. Of course, the big failure of the Lake Delhi Dam that was in late July when rising flood water from the Maquoketa River ate a 30-foot-wide hole in this earthen dam, causing the water to drop 45 feet to the river below and threatening, at least for some time, a few towns downstream. And any follow-up to the did I leave any areas out to begin with? And any follow-up to the flooding and comments there?
On the commodity prices, Ben, I would just say in the agriculture arena, that obviously has insulated a good part of western Iowa, rural Iowa, from some larger economic trends. But a concern going forward is that because of those relatively high prices, with the deficit slashing commissions meeting in Washington, D.C., the Simpson-Bowles Commission and other groups, the Iowa Republican Party, in fact, has it in their platform that they're calling for the elimination of farm subsidies. So it's great that we have these higher prices and they've buoyed our economy, but one wonders what that portends in the future.
Mm-hmm. What is the status of the Lake Delhi Dam that was? Todd, do you have an update on that?
Well, there's a gubernatorial task force that's been meeting and has recommended some sort of public financing to rebuild the dam. Now, that's sort of the interesting debate that's raging over that, is that it was a private lake, a privately owned dam, I guess, that created a lake that was mostly for recreational use. Lots of private landowners around it. And the question is, should public funds be used to rebuild that dam and to refill that lake? FEMA has backed away from providing assistance because they don't feel that that's their role. Now you've got this task force that says that there is a public role. And I guess, I mean, maybe the next legislature is going to have to take a look at that and decide if that's something they want to do. It's been fairly politically controversial, though.
Janine, you covered some of the flooding throughout the state in the course of 2010. Any particular story stand out for you?
I just remember I stopped in Colfax, and obviously there was flooding in Ames, you know, repeat of some of the 1993 damage. Hilton Coliseum's floor was floating again, its basketball floor. But when I was in Colfax, they had their major highway 117 closed off. And so what I witnessed is just people were so weary. They just felt beat down. Like, why does this keep happening? We thought these were 500-year floods or 100-year floods, and it's every 2 years. And I had one gentleman tell me, he said, "You don't want me to tell you what I tell Mother Nature."
It was not fit for radio.
Exactly. And he said, "I say it out loud to myself sometimes, but that's it." But that's my point, I guess, is that people just are starting to feel weary about this. Like, wow, when is this going to end? And doesn't appear it's going to anytime soon. So that's what I think is so discouraging. People can pick themselves up after a flood if they think, okay, that was a one-time thing. But if they're afraid this is going to happen every 5 years, it's a lot to deal with.
We want to get in one more of our top 10 news stories of 2010 before we take a break here. At number five, we put the egg recall late this summer. Nationwide recall of eggs from two Iowa producers was blamed for salmonella outbreaks across the United States. Hillendale Farms of Iowa recalled 170 million eggs produced by farms at Alden and West Union. A DeCoster-owned company, Wright County Egg, recalled 380 million eggs from five farms. And this was really a huge story nationwide, where we saw how interconnected our food chain is in the U.S. Doug, your comment on that, the fallout for Iowa and the Iowa egg producers.
Well, I believe yesterday the U.S. Senate dealt with that with a food safety bill that passed the Senate. Senator Harkin was key from our state in shepherding that through. That will bring the FDA more into the picture in terms of regulating facilities. And we all just take it for granted that when we go to, you know, our local grocery store that the food's going to be good. But, you know, so much illness is related to food. And this legislation that passed is no doubt was given some momentum by the incident with DeCoster.
Mm-hmm. As our State House reporter Janine Beck, what's your take on the egg recall and its fallout?
Well, it'll be one of the few Iowa stories that also makes, I believe, national top 10 lists in some cases. And what's interesting is there were some people who complained, well, this is the fault of factory-style farming. Iowa's Agriculture Secretary Bill Northey says, no, this could have happened at any size. You wondered if there would be some fallout. I don't believe there will be. I mean, it already seems to have fallen off the radar for some. And I don't know that this upcoming session, I'm sure we'll see one or two bills introduced that deal with this kind of thing. But for the large part, I think they'll just let the federal government deal with it. Like Douglas said, you know, you have the bill that just passed the Senate yesterday. And I don't know that state lawmakers will get involved.
Todd Dorman, before we have to take a break, a quick comment about the egg recall.
I think from a food safety standpoint, federal legislation is appropriate. I mean, at the state level, I think we've had this debate, and I think it's pretty much over. I mean, both parties have essentially said, well, we're going to have factory-style farming in the state. We're going to have statewide regulations, and we don't want the regulations to be too onerous. So, I mean, this is the sort of agriculture that we're going to have here forward. It was interesting during the gubernatorial campaign, there was a lot of sniping about, you know, whose fault is it that Jack DeCoster is doing business in this state? Well, I mean, I sort of think the answer is both parties have done their part to allow that sort of farming to happen.
Todd Dorman with us, Cedar Rapids Gazette columnist, along with Doug Burns of the Daily Times Herald in Carroll, and our own Iowa Public Radio State House reporter joining us this hour, Janine Beck. They'll be with us for this second half hour. We've gone through what we see as numbers 5 through 10, the egg recall, flooding, the weather, and also the Becker trial, the Panther basketball, the Bellevue trampling. We want to talk about the top 4 news stories of 2010 as we see them at Iowa Public Radio when we return. No calls today because of the nature of our countdown show, but you can find our top 10 list on Facebook. We're also on Twitter. Leave behind a comment or send us a tweet. We'll be back with the top 4 news stories from Iowa Public Radio of 2010 after this short break. This is Iowa Public Radio. This is an encore edition of The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. And in this edition of our program, we're looking back at 2010 to the top Iowa news stories of the year. And we're counting them down. We've been through 6 of them. We started off talking about Panther basketball, the great year that the Panthers had, and on to some tragedies, the trampling in Bellevue, the far eastern Iowa town of Bellevue on July 4th, the Mark Becker trial, the verdict and the sentencing there, and also the egg recall that we remember from late this summer, the flooding, all the weather. Those have comprised our 5 through 10 count on this top 10 countdown list, joining us to talk about these, review these news stories, and discuss their further implications. Todd Dorman, Cedar Rapids Gazette columnist, Doug Burns of the Daily Times Herald in Carroll, and Iowa Public Radio State House reporter Janine Beck. Let's pick up where we left off. We have listed at number four this fall. Nearly 3,000 Iowa Army National Guard soldiers officially left home for what is a one-year deployment to Afghanistan. This made it the largest deployment of the Iowa National Guard since the Second World War. The 2nd Brigade Combat Team of the 34th Infantry Division comprises 2,800 soldiers from Iowa, about 350 from the Nebraska Guard, and about 100 from other states. Let's talk a little bit about these massive Iowa National Guard deployments, how you've been covering them around the state, our guest journalists here. Todd Dorman, how has that overlapped with your reporting and writing as a columnist?
Well, I think the story that's coming next sort of ties into that. But I think, you know, too often it seems that the Afghanistan conflict, though really important, has fallen off the radar for a lot of Americans. I think there was a poll I saw before the election where only like a quarter of voters said they were following news of the conflict closely. And I think that one thing that this serves to do, this call up in Iowa, is that it refocuses Iowans back on why this conflict is important. And
right, and it's really important what you mentioned there, because we think back at our 2008 campaign. People across the nation polled as what were the most important things, priorities of this nation. Iraq and Afghanistan, bringing closure there, were some of the top stories. Now they've, as you say, practically fallen off the radar. Janine Beck at the State House, what has been the perspective there as a State House reporter?
Well, Iowa last spring was the first state in the nation to pass all 10 Department of Defense recommended changes to policy to help those serving overseas, help the military men and women and families. And it was everything from, some foreclosure hold-offs, you know, if you were serving overseas, to maybe some benefits, to Veterans Day off, if possible, for veterans, and things like this. But this list of 10 military family relief acts. And so the legislature is very aware. But I do think what Todd's saying is that I remember when Timothy Orr, who is the head of the Iowa National Guard, spoke during the condition of the guard speech, and he talked about how this massive unit call-up would affect every community in Iowa. But I suspect there are large swaths of people who it still doesn't impact in a way. You know, if your family's not really involved with the military, a lot of people really aren't touched by it. And so that's why, you know, you have to kind of keep it in the forefront for people to remind them that a lot of people got loved ones a far away from them this time of year.
Closely. Yeah, yes, Doug.
Burns. No, I would just say that, you know, in the last week, President Obama gave us an update on the situation in Afghanistan, but just in terms of military issues alone, the don't ask, don't tell issue has just overwhelmed that in terms of attention. Another concern that a lot of us in rural America have is that there's a disproportionate share of rural Americans who are shouldering the burden in conflicts. It's an issue we raised with President Obama before he was President Obama when he was running for office. During the gubernatorial campaign, Terry Branstad was at an event here and literally shed tears and broke down when he was talking about the commitment and effort of our National Guard. And those were genuine emotions from Branstad and reported as such.
Okay. On Tuesday, November 16th, the Hiawatha soldier, Army Staff Sergeant Sal Junta, became the first living recipient of the Medal of Honor since the Vietnam War during a ceremony at the White House. In the fall of 2007, Sal Junta was on patrol with 17 other men in a remote part of Afghanistan called the Coringal Valley. His squad was ambushed by Taliban fighters, and according to Army reports, as Junta was trying to link up with the rest of his squad, he noticed two of the Taliban fighters were carrying his friend, Sergeant Josh Brennan, away. Junta ran after Brennan, exposing himself to enemy fire. He shot and killed one of the fighters, and the other ran away. Junta continued toward Brennan. He grabbed him by the vest, pulled him to cover. Brennan was still conscious, but his wounds were severe. He died later that day. Here's Sal Junta on this program a short time ago.
That day, I didn't do anything in my eyes spectacular or amazing, because there was a lot of things that were going on and there was a lot of danger, and no one person was in more danger or less danger than the other ones.
Sal Giunta, speaking on this program a few months ago, spoke to us by phone from Italy, where he is stationed. Earlier, we were talking about the Iowa National Guard deployment. This is what Staff Sergeant Giunta said about those serving overseas.
I don't think there's anyone in Afghanistan or Iraq right now that you can't say is going above and beyond the call of duty. I mean, they're leaving their families, they're leaving their wives, their children, their mothers, their fathers, their grandparents. They're leaving life in a fairly secure country behind to go to a third world country and fight. So that seems pretty much to me above and beyond.
Sal Giunta, the first living recipient of the Medal of Honor since the Vietnam War. Jeanine Beck, you covered the Iowa ceremony at the State House for Sal Giunta. How did this change? It was certainly a great moment of pride for all Iowans, for our state.
There was a nice crowd gathered, several hundred gathered to see him receive this award. Many were veterans who just wanted to see a fellow veteran honored. Many were friends and family who had grown up with him. His cousin Nick Giunta was there and said he was so impressed, not by his cousin's heroics, because that he expected of him, but more that he had become such a good public speaker. I mean, he is the most humble when he speaks, and he constantly turns it back to those who he trained with, those who he served with, or friends and family that helped him along the way. I mean, he's a really nice young man, and it's a pleasure to watch somebody like that then receive such a high honor. And when you're covering something like that, you think, wow, I get to watch a little bit of history, and that's when you really like your job. But yeah, it was neat to see so many people turn out to celebrate that.
Doug Burns, in Carroll, you also covered the Giunta story.
We had a nice connection with that, Ben. There was a young man who's served in an exemplary way himself, Adam Espinover, a 1999 Carroll High School graduate. And Sal actually invited Espinover and his family to be at the White House with him for that ceremony, so we were able to get kind of a firsthand account of that awfully moving event from one of our own here in Carroll, and it just showed us how close some of these military families can get. It was exceptionally moving.
Hiawatha Soldier Army Staff Sergeant Sal Giunta, first living recipient of the Medal of Honor since the Vietnam War. Of course, Hiawatha in eastern Iowa, your beat, Todd Dorman. Your thoughts before we move on?
Well, what makes this story so compelling is the fact that he's so much like, I mean, he could be anyone's neighbor. He could be the kid down the street, and those are the sort of folks that are fighting the war. I mean, normal everyday school students from any town in Iowa, and it also the harrowing tale happened the day that he earned the award. Sort of shined a spotlight on the truly tough fighting that's going on in Afghanistan. I mean, this is a really, really rugged, awful war. Mm-hmm. And I think his story shined the light on the job, the hard job that a lot of soldiers are doing. And I think, as he said, that's what he hoped would come out of the award, out of his award. And I think anyone who watched the 60 Minute piece on what happened that day, it certainly shined a light on the tough job that those folks are doing.
And in my discussion with Sal Giunta, what came through to me was just the excellent military training that our men and women have over there, and how this unit out in the hills, mountains of Afghanistan, really did act in unison. And when that ambush came, literally a few yards in front of Sal Giunta's squad, they reacted as an ambush being the worst of all situations in close proximity, reacted as they were trained, as one the squad was. So let's move on before our hour comes to an end. We're recalling the top 10 Iowa news stories of the past year of 2010, as seen by Iowa Public Radio news staff. Our story comes in at number two on our list of top 10 stories, is introduced by Lieutenant Governor-elect Kim Reynolds.
Ladies and gentlemen, your Governor-elect, Terry Bradshaw!
Thank you.
After a 12-year absence, Iowa's longest-serving governor of 16 years, Republican Terry Branstad, was reelected to the post. Governor Chet Culver became the first incumbent governor to lose since 1962. This was also the most expensive Iowa gubernatorial race, about $17 million spent. Branstad largely campaigned on a platform of fiscal responsibility and job creation. Here's some of what he said during his acceptance speech.
When I was growing up on a farm near Leland, Iowa, I learned an old saying that I've always lived by. The harder you work, the luckier you get. Well, tonight, I feel like the luckiest guy on the face of the earth.
Terry Branstad during his acceptance speech. Let's go around the horn here and get observations from our journalists. Can we start with you, Doug Burns, out in the western part of the state, in Carroll?
Well, I just found it interesting that after 16 years, Branstad thought he was so essential to the rest of the state that he needed another 20 years. He's almost like a political zombie. He just won't leave the scene or die. There's a definite element of narcissism there. What will be interesting going forward, though, is to see who Branstad, throws his support behind in 2012 for the caucuses. On the campaign trail, he mentioned Governor Mitch Daniels from Indiana a lot. I doubt he's ever in Palin's camp, so I think he could play a key role there. And one last quick point, don't forget that U.S. Rep. Steve King from out here in western Iowa was heavily considering entering the race, and had Branstad not entered the race, we might have Governor Steve King today.
Mm. And Janine Beck, as our Iowa Public Radio Statehouse reporter, this has a lot to do with what you'll be doing over the next 4 years and going back to territory you've been before and covering Governor Branstad.
That's right. When I was first started covering the State House, he was the governor. And I remember thinking then that he had clearly been governor a long time since when he was elected. I had been in either fifth or sixth grade and written a report about that race between him and Roxanne Conlin. And then he was still governor when I began covering him. And there were people of that generation who only knew him as governor. I mean, they hadn't had any other governor hardly. And then when I was out on the campaign trail with him, it was fun to watch him approach college students today who had never had him hardly as governor. I mean, they had in their lifetime, but had never been old enough to remember him. And so he was reintroducing himself to an entire new generation. But that's how he campaigns. He's tireless. He remembers everyone he's ever met. And that's, you know, that's hard to beat for
right.
people.
Does
that's
he remember,
what they like on the campaign trail.
Does he remember people who call him zombies? A zombie?
I'm sure he will after today.
Todd Dorman, what do you make of Branstad becoming governor again? You know, it was easy to see coming. We saw it in the polls. The polls were in fact right. And Governor Culver, the reason behind his downfall,
well,
is it a mystery or is it easy to see?
To me, that's sort of the astounding thing, having lived here my whole life, is that, you know, Iowans just don't throw governors out after a term. I mean, we sort of have to, you know, make them a member of the family for a couple generations or something like that. But, yeah, I mean, he, you know, rightly or wrongly, Governor Culver wrestled in the last 18 months, 2 years of his administration with this idea that he wasn't competent, this idea that he, you know, the film office fell apart and there were just little bumps and bruises that his administration kept sustaining. And so when you bring in someone like Branstad, who obviously a lot of people think is competent, he served a long time, that was the contrast that the Republicans wanted, and that's ultimately, I think, why Branstad won. Culver could just never shake the idea that he wasn't in complete control, and despite the fact that really, if you look at the numbers objectively, Iowa is in a lot better shape than a lot of states. I mean, the outgoing governor could make a fairly strong case that he had brought us through the economic crisis fairly well, but it just didn't resonate. It's like voters had already made their minds up about him.
I understand, Todd, you were back when Governor Branstad was first in office, you were a legislative page and actually had your picture taken with.
I do. It's hanging by my desk. I look a little older. You know, Terry just looks exactly the same. I don't know what happened.
Let's go to what we see here at Iowa Public Radio as the number one news story of 2010, as seen by the news staff at Iowa Public Radio. Three Iowa Supreme Court justices ousted from the bench by a 55% vote of the voters on November 2nd. Chief Justice Marsha Ternus and Associate Justices Michael Streit, David Baker were not retained because of their part in a unanimous ruling last year making the way for same-sex marriage. Here's what Chief Justice Ternus said before the vote in late September.
Before you vote, in the retention elections this year reflect on the rule of law and the need for impartial justice for all, free of politics and free of special interest.
Sioux City businessman and former gubernatorial candidate Bob Vanderplaats led the effort to unseat the justices. Here's what he had to say about the voters' decision.
The people of Iowa had a resounding voice tonight of saying we're not going to allow activist courts to make our law, to execute our law, and to amend our Constitution. And it's we the people who are still in charge. That's why we're a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, not of the courts, by the courts, for the courts.
Bob Vanderplaats, who led this effort to unseat three Iowa Supreme Court justices, undoubtedly one of the most important. We rated as number one, but also a news story that has legs to carry over into 2011. Your comment on this, Janine Beck.
I thought it was interesting. It showed a couple of things. One, the split in Iowa in different counties. In some western Iowa counties, people voted more than 2-1 to oust the justices. But then in Polk County, district court judge who initially granted or ruled that that was unconstitutional and then sent that on to the Supreme Court retained his seat because of the way Polk County voted. So it really showed a difference between views in Iowa, depending on where you lived. And I thought that was striking. I also thought it was striking the resurrection of Bob Vanderplaats, because I remember thinking a couple of weeks after when he called a news conference, here was a man who had lost three races for governor, and yet I'm still covering him. Usually that doesn't happen. And it's because this really resurrected his political career. Where he goes from here, I don't know. But, he's still in the news now. And the third thing I guess I would say is that the way that the Chief Justice and Marsha Ternus, also David Baker and Michael Strite, handled this, never once speaking down to voters, I think, whether you agreed with their ruling or not, I thought they handled the whole situation admirably, in the sense that they were talking about, well, here's a system we would like you to uphold. But they never tried to say to voters, you are wrong, or you don't have legitimate feelings on this issue, or anything like that. And I think they refused to campaign. They refused to bring money into this. And I thought that was at least admirable.
Very quickly, we're running out of time. Doug Burns with a comment, followed by Todd Dorman. Doug.
Yeah, I thought the most disturbing number I saw in the entire election season was that 83%, the Des Moines Register had a poll, 83% of Iowans thought that justices should more reflect the public's will. And that's exactly what justices are not supposed to do. Our Supreme Court has a rich history of being ahead of the curve on social justice and individual liberty matters. We were way ahead in Iowa, way ahead of the Dred Scott decision on slavery, and we could go on and on. Michael Gartner had a brilliant piece in City View looking at the history of the Supreme Court.
Doug Burns, I want to go to Todd Dorman. We're running out of time. Todd, your closing comment
I'm with Doug. That's disturbing, and I'm afraid that the idea of retention has been changed now, and it's going to become more politicized, but we'll deal with that going forward. But I think that this has got to be a wake-up call or a warning shot to folks that want to keep same-sex marriage legal in this state, that they're going to have to fight hard for it. They're not going to be able to have issue symposiums and not run TV ads and not do any yard signs or any of the traditional politicking. They're going to have to get into the dirt and fight. And
okay.
That's just the way that's the only way that you win.
Todd Dorman, thank you very much. Cedar Rapids Gazette columnist Doug Burns of the Daily Times Herald and Carroll, and Iowa Public Radio State House reporter Janine Beck, thank you for accompanying us on this list of top 10 news stories from 2010. Thank you so much. And we want to leave this thought because we pay tribute to someone who left us much too soon in 2010. On January 26th, Iowa Public Radio Talk of Iowa host Greg Shanley passed away at the age of 49. Greg was born in Toledo, Ohio. He was raised in a suburb of Cleveland. He joined KUNI in Cedar Falls in 1987, later became the news director, and was responsible for creating a State House Bureau reporter, a position which remains today. Later, he was producer for this program, The Exchange. After that, the host of Talk of Iowa.
It's a beautiful summer day. Why not have some friends over? Yeah, maybe a few more. Great weather, good friends, an ideal time to barbecue. Grilling is the topic of today's show. Two contests are coming up. Have you thought about entering?
Voice of our friend Greg Shanley, left behind a wife, Sonia, and a daughter, Leah, a son, Evan, a daughter-in-law, Angie, and grandson, Titan. We at Iowa Public Radio have missed Greg's professionalism, his cheer, his wit, and his friendship. Our thoughts go out during this holiday time, especially to his loved ones. The Exchange is produced by Alex Hoyer and Catherine Perkins. I want to thank especially all the Iowa Public Radio reporters for their contributions of sound. They captured the great sound you heard this hour. Thanks to them. Production assistance today for this program, Mitchell Schmidt. Technical support from Dennis Reese. In Des Moines, we had help from John Pemble. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. Podcasting and on-demand audio of The Exchange, available by going to iowapublicradio.org. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. Contact us anytime, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.